Blog Talk Radio.
This is Walter Dean. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean, along with three guests, Jerome Williams and Paul Willis, spelled W-I-L-U-S-Z. This week we are featuring Thelonious Monk, who was born in 1917 and passed on in 1982. The research that was done said he was 64, but when I put 17 and 82 together, it comes out 74. So somebody's messed up. I don't think it's me. He's known actually for the type of jazz that many types of jazz. Actually, he created a lot of them himself. But he started off in the bebop eras. And is known for jazz and hard bop, and cool jazz, and some kind of other weird jazz cause that I don't even know anything about because he was a creator of so many different styles. And I'd like to have some of my other compadres tell you a little bit about Monk that they were able to research.
Yeah, this is Paul. I thought that what was interesting was that Monk was one of five musicians who were on the cover of Time magazine. So it was Monk, Louis Armstrong, Dave Brubeck, Ellington, which was on a segment of this program, Wynton Marsalis, and Thelonious Monk himself. He also had his first recording in 1944 with Coleman Hawkins. And so Monk was able to return the favor and had him join himself and with John Coltrane for a recording session back in 1957.
He was born in 1917. Let's add that up. He started actually performing in 17, 27, 37, actually 23 years of age. Not bad, but, you know, like most performers at that particular time, like Miles was performing even earlier. Miles started performing when he was 17 years old.
17, wow.
Yeah, so, you know, like Monk was a little late on the draw, but he came along very, very well later.
And made his own.
Made his own stuff.
Made his own stuff up.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
You know, it's been said that his playing career really took off about 17, 18, 19 years of age. When he started playing in this jazz nightclub called Minton's Playhouse, which was in Manhattan. And at that time, much of his style was developed during his time in Minton's. His style, they call it, was crucial in the formulation of bebop. And this style was further developed by some great artists like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Christian, Charlie Parker, and also later Miles Davis, believe it or not.
Yeah, oh yeah. Okay, he hung out with those guys anyway. You know, there wasn't they all at that particular time. Most of the musicians helped each other. It was a weird kind of world that they lived in. But Monk is one of the very few musicians that was able to get a PhD from Juilliard School of Music. And you know, like that might be one of the reasons why it drove him half sad. he got sick. If you listen to his music as he went on through his life. It got weirder and weirder, but he started off. He was really cool. Maybe you can pull up something. We can listen to some documentary about this great, fantastic musician.
Mr. Williams, come up and then have the piano there, but the piano was tuned and everything was top notch, so the music would come out and be like it was supposed to be. And the man was very artistic and very particular about everything that he liked and playing the music and whatnot and people that came there to listen to it. You're talking about Monk. I'm talking about Monk. How many of you folks met Monk? I met Monk in the early part of 40, 41. 118th Street between 7th and 7th Mrs. Avenue. On your left-hand side. Women's Playhouse.
Thank you.
His melody, his chords were musical, his colors, his rhythmic sense, and the spiritual feeling in it. When you heard his music, it just carried you away. Malcolm Studio was a combination of his perfectionism and his very basic, I think, inability to understand what the hell was supposed to be so difficult about his music. You know, the attitude that he understood, why couldn't you?
All of that, he showed me that all the values of our music
like Stride Piano, for example. Wrote was a Stride pianist all of his life, and he would write even a very complicated piece of music, and he would play somewhere along the line Stride Piano, because that was the way he heard things and the way he organized things. Playing Stride Piano was this incredible period around the 20s and 30s, you know, and 40s also, with a great, great pianist, such as James B. Johnson, Lucky Roberts, Louis Ryan Smith, and many others. And they would play a lot of rent parties, you know, and the piano became like a tour orchestra. And they would play for dancing. And James B. Johnson, ironically, he lived in San Juan Hill, the same area as Monk, you know. And James B. was one of our really master pianists. And they all went to Stride. And Stride was a wonderful way for pianists to swing. I like Stride.
Understand Thelonious if you realize that in many ways he was himself a tremendously traditional artist. He had a great awareness of the past and jazz. You know, the area that he grew up in the West 60s in New York was an area that James P. Johnson was living in at that time, and apparently James P. was a childhood hero of his. And I recall a recording session when I did the first solo album I did with Monk. We were standing in a control room listening to a playback of an improvised blues that he had done. And he turned around and said to me, "Gee, I sound just like James P. Johnson."
And for me, Thelonious was wonderful because he put the traditional and modern and put together. So there was no separation, you know. And he had a beautiful blues called Functional. I would play this for you. You would feel a bit of Stride.
Trumpet, but they said he said, "Barnacle Trouble."
Cole in the chat so much. And the new teacher told my mother that he shouldn't play the trumpet because it was affecting, you know, his blowing. And he got interested in the piano. So my brother was about playing, and he found out he could play. Pick up any tune that came along, you know, about the music. And then my mother said that if he were going to play, he should learn how to play the right way. So the teacher was teaching me, which I didn't like piano lessons. He started teaching my brother in that place. So he took lessons.
There was a strong tradition of education. There was a strong tradition of religion involved in that. There was a strong structure for respect and authority for elders and those kind of things. And those values were very, very important to the elders. And I think it had an overall influence on the way he went about his job in his music, which was very workmanlike fashion.
That were played in by Monk. What you might hear is Blue Monk was the last piece that he performed here that you just listened to. You heard his sister talk about him, and you heard his son give a presentation about his father, which is very, very interesting that you were getting those particular pieces. And what happens is that the elements of Monk were so far outreaching that it was very, very difficult for most musicians to try to keep up with him and what he was capable of doing. His chords were constrained. He was a swing musician as far as playing the piano is concerned, but more importantly, Monk also had a large ability to look at things completely different than the way other people did. But he actually invented chords that he played with the right hand as opposed to playing it with the left hand because it was swinging with that particular hand. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to continue and see if we can pull up something here that Monk did. Let's see if you can go on to Monk and see what he did. Straight No Chaser. That's right here about the truth about Monk. Right here. Thank you. All right. Where?
Since about Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Spear Monk. October 10th, 1917. February 17th, 1982 was an American jazz pianist and composer. His interpretive and compositional style formally formed in 1947, totally changed in the following 25 years. Pianist, founder of the bebop, he also played under the influence of hard bop and global jazz. He is known for his unique style of improvisation, as well as having composed several jazz standards such as Round Midnight, Straight No Chaser, 52nd Street Theme, and Blue Monk. Early life, born in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, his family moved shortly after to Manhattan, in New York. In that apartment, he would live until the end of his days. He began playing the piano at the age of 6 and, although he received some musical education, was essentially a self-taught. His first influences were two of the great stride pianists, James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith. During his adolescence, he began to work in some red parties playing the organ and the piano in the Baptist church. He studied at the Stuyvesant Institute, although he never got to graduate. In 1935, he decided to go on a trip to travel the world accompanying an evangelist preacher with a piano. After 2 years, he returned to his hometown and formed his own quartet, performing in various clubs until in 1941 drummer Kenny Clark chose him as a house pianist to play at Minton's Playhouse, the legendary Harlem club where he played I Would Breathe a Bebop. His style at the time was described as hard swinging, with marked influences from Art Tatum, Duke Ellington, James P. Johnson, and other pianists. During his stay at Minton's, Monk perfected his unique style, participating in sessions called cutting competitions with the most renowned soloists of the time. During those years, Monk came into contact with musicians such as Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Sonny Rollins, Milt Jackson, and John Coltrane, who were laying the foundations of bebop. In 1944, he made his first recordings with the Coleman Hawkins Quartet. In 1947, he recorded for the first time as leader of his own band and published his debut LP, Genius of Modern Music, Volume 1, which showed his talent for both composition and improvisation. The same year, he married Nellie Smith, and in 1949, the couple had a son, T.S. Monk, who would be a jazz drummer. His daughter Barbara was born in 1953. In August of 1951, he was arrested by the New York police, accused of possession of narcotics, because he refused to denounce his friend, the also pianist Bud Powell, who presumably belonged to the drug. His permission to act in nightclubs in which alcohol was sold was withdrawn, an authorization, the New York City Cabaret card, which was issued by the police. He spent the first half of the 50s composing, recording albums, and acting in theaters and tours outside the city. After recording several albums for Blue Note between 1947 and 1952, he signed a contract with Prestige, for which he recorded between 1952 and 1954 some of his most important albums, including collaborations with saxophonist Sonny Rollins and with drummer Art Blakey. Producer Warren Keepnews of Riverside Records persuaded him to record an album with Duke Ellington themes and another with standards so that his music would become more accessible to the average jazz audience. In 1956, he recorded the classic Brilliant Corners, and from the following year, the changes in his life took place. Prestige Records, 1952 to 1954. After intermittent recording sessions for Blue Note from 1947 to 1952, Monk was under contract to Prestige Records for the following 2 years. With Prestige, he cut several highly significant, but at the time under-recognized, albums, including collaborations with the saxophonist Sonny Rollins and the drummers Art Blakey and Max Roach. In 1954, Monk participated in a Christmas Eve session, which produced most of the albums Bags Groove and Miles Davis and the Modern Jazz Giants by Davis. In his autobiography, Miles, Davis claimed that the alleged anger and tension between them did not take place and that the claims of blows being exchanged were rumors and a misunderstanding. In 1954, Monk paid his first visit to Paris. As well as performing at concerts, he recorded a solo piano session for French radio, later issued as an album by Discs Vogue. Backstage, Mary Lou Williams introduced him to Baroness Panemkinek de Koenigswerter, a member of the Rothschild family and the patroness of several New York City jazz musicians. She was a close friend for the rest of Monk's life, including taking responsibility for him when she and Monk were charged with marijuana possession.
Riverside Records, 1955 to 1961. Thelonious Monk, 1961. By the time of his signing to Riverside, Monk was highly regarded by his peers and by some critics, but his records remained poor sellers and his music was still regarded as too difficult for more mainstream acceptance. Indeed, with Monk's consent, Riverside had managed to buy out his...
Hey, what are you doing up there?
Well, I'm applying for a new job with a pause.
What happens, we have people always trying to mess with us.
$108.24. He willingly recorded two albums of jazz standards as a means of increasing his profile. Thelonious Monk plays Duke Ellington, 1955, and the unique Thelonious Monk, 1956. On Brilliant Corners, recorded in late 1956, Monk mainly performed his own music. The complex title track, which featured rhymes, was so difficult to play that the final version had to be edited together for multiple takes. The album, however, was largely regarded as the first success from Monk. After having his cabaret card restored, Monk relaunched his New York career with a landmark six-month residency at the Five Spot Cafe in the East Village neighborhood of New York beginning in June 1957-6, leading a quartet with John Coltrane on tenor saxophone, Wilbur Ware on bass, and Shadow Wilson on drums. Little of this group's music was documented owing to contractual problems. Coltrane was signed to Prestige at the time, but Monk refused to return to his former label. One studio session by the quartet was made for Riverside, three tunes which were not released until 1961 by the subsidiary of Label Jazz went along with outtakes from a larger group recording with Coltrane to Hawkins, those results appearing in 1957 as the album Monk's Music. An amateur tape from the Five Spot, a later September 1958 reunion with Coltrane sitting in for Johnny Griffin, was issued on Blue Note in 1993. And a recording of the quartet performing at a Carnegie Hall concert on November 29th was recorded in high fidelity by Voice of America engineers, rediscovered in the collection of the Library of Congress in 2005 and released by Blue Note. Crepuscule with Nelly, recorded in 1957, was Monk's only once called for a composed composition, meaning that there is no improvising. It is Monk's concerto, if you will, and in some ways it speaks for itself. But he wrote it very, very carefully and very deliberately and really struggled to make it sound the way it sounds. It was his love song for Nelly, said the author of the definitive Monk biography, Robin Kelly. The Five Spot residency ended Christmas 1957. Coltrane left to rejoin Davis's group, and the band was effectively disbanded. Monk did not form another long-term band until June 1958 when he began a second residency at the Five Spot, again with a quartet, this time with Griffin, and later Charlie Rouse, on tenor, Ahmed Abdul Malik on bass, and Ray Haynes on drums. On October 15, 1958, en route to a week-long engagement for the quartet at the Comedy Club in Baltimore, Maryland, Monk and the Golden Sorter were detained by police in Wilmington, Delaware. When Monk refused to answer the policeman's questions or cooperate with them, they beat him with a blackjack. Though the police were authorized to search the vehicle and found narcotics in suitcases held in the trunk of the Baroness's car, Judge Christie of the Delaware Superior Court ruled that the unlawful detention of the pair and the beating of Monk rendered the consent to the search void as given under duress. Thelonious Monk, 1964, Columbia Records, 1962 to 1970. After extended negotiations, Monk signed in 1962 with Columbia Records, one of the Big Four American record labels of the day. Monk's relationship with Riverside had soured over disagreements concerning royalty payments and had concluded with a brace of European live albums. He had not recorded a studio album since Five by Monk by Five in June 1959. Working with producer Taylor Masell on his debut for Columbia, the sessions in the first week of November had a lineup that had been with him for 2 years. Tenor saxophonist Rouse, who worked with Monk from 1959 to 1970, bassist John Moore, and drummer Frankie Dunlop. Monk's Dream, his first Columbia album, was released in 1963. Columbia's resources allowed Monk to be promoted more heavily than earlier in his career. Monk's Dream became the best-selling LP of his lifetime. And on February 28, 1964, He appeared on the cover of Time magazine, being featured in the article The Loneliest Monk. The cover article originally was supposed to run in November 1963, but it was postponed due to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. According to biographer Kelly, the 1964 Time appearance came because Barry Fell, who wrote the cover story, wanted to write about a jazz musician, and almost by default Monk was chosen because they thought Ray Charles and Miles Davis were too controversial. Monk wasn't so political. Of course, I challenged it in the biography, Kelly wrote. Monk continued to record studio albums, including Criss Cross, also in 1963, and Underground in 1968. But by the Columbia years, his compositional output was limited, and only his final Columbia studio record, Underground, featured a substantial number of new tunes, including his only waltz timepiece, Ugly Beauty. As had been the case with Riverside, his period with Columbia contains many live albums, including Miles and Monk at Newport, 1963, Live at the Eclem, and Live at the Jazz Workshop, the latter two recorded in 1964, the last not being released until 1982. After the departure of Orr and Dunlop, the remainder of the rhythm section in Monk's quartet during the bulk of his Columbia period was Larry Gills on bass and Ben Wiley on drums, both of whom joined in 1964. Along with Miles, they remained with Monk for over 4 years, his longest-serving band. Later, life and death, Monk had disappeared from the scene by the mid-1970s and made only a small number of appearances during the final decade of his life. His last studio recordings as a leader were made in November 1971 for the English Black Lion label, near the end of a worldwide tour with the Giants of Jazz, a group which included Gillespie, Kyle Winding, Sonny Stitt, Al McKibben, and Blakey. Bassist McKibben, who had known Monk for over 20 years and played on his final tour in 1971, later said, on that tour, Monk said about two words. I mean literally maybe two words. He didn't say good morning, good night, what time? Nothing. Why? I don't know. He sent word back after the tour was over that the reason he couldn't communicate or play was that Art Blakey and I were so ugly. A different side of Monk is revealed in Lewis Porter's biography, John Coltrane, His Life and Music. Coltrane states, Monk is exactly the opposite of Miles Davis. He talks about music all the time, and he wants so much for you to understand that if, by chance, you ask him something, he'll spend hours if necessary to explain it to you. Blakey reports that Monk was excellent at both chess and checkers. The documentary film Felonious Monk, Straight, No Chaser, 1988, attributes Monk's quirky behavior to mental illness. In the film, Monk's son says that his father sometimes did not recognize him, and he reports that Monk was hospitalized on several occasions owing to an unspecified mental illness that worsened in the late 1960s. No reports or diagnoses were ever publicized, but Monk would often become excited for 2 or 3 days, then pace for days after that, after which he would withdraw and stop speaking.
Well, we are evidently having a period right now. It's called, I don't even know what it's called, actually, to be perfectly honest with you, because for some reason, we started playing the documentary, it just stopped completely.
Doctors recommended electroconvulsive therapy as a treatment option for Monk's illness, but his family would not allow it.
Good.
Antipsychotics and lithium were prescribed instead. Other theories abound. Leslie Gorse, author of the book Straight, No Chaser, The Life and Genius of Thelonious Monk, 1997, reported that at least one of Monk's psychiatrists failed to find evidence of manic depression, bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia. Another doctor maintains that Monk was misdiagnosed and prescribed drugs during his hospital stay that may have caused brain damage.
Yeah.
As his health declined, Monk's last 6 years were spent as a guest in Weehawken, New Jersey, home of his long-standing patron and friend, Parmenica de Koenigswerder, who had also nursed Parker during his final illness. She proved to be a steadfast presence, as did his own wife, Nellie, especially as his life descended into further isolation. Monk did not play the piano during this time, even though one was present in his room, and he spoke to few visitors. He died of a stroke on February 17, 1982, and was buried in Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, New York. In 1993, he was awarded the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 2006. He was awarded a special Pulitzer Prize for a body of distinguished and innovative musical composition that has had a significant and enduring impact on the evolution of jazz. The Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz was established in 1986 by the Monk family and Maria Fisher. Its mission is to offer public school-based jazz education programs for young people around the globe, helping students develop imaginative thinking, creativity, curiosity, a positive self-image, and a respect for their own and others' cultural heritage. In addition to hosting an annual international jazz competition since 1987, the Institute also helped, through its partnership with UNESCO, designate April 30, 2012, as the first annual International Jazz Day. Monk was inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame in 2009. Tributes. Soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy performed as Monk's accompanist in 1960. Monk's tunes became a permanent part of his repertoire in concert and on albums. Lacy recorded many albums entirely focused on Monk's compositions. Gunther Schumer wrote the work Variants on a Theme of Thelonious Monk in 1960. It was later performed and recorded by other artists, including Ornette Coleman, Eric Dolphy, and Bill Evans. Round Midnight Variations is a collection of variations on the song Round Midnight, premiered in 2002. Composers contributing included Milton Babbitt, William Borkum, David Crumb, George Crumb, Michael Dougherty, John Harmison, Joel Hoffman, Aaron J. Cunnis, Gerald Levinson, Tobias Picker, Frederick Orzewski, Augusta Reed Thomas, and Michael Tork. Tribute albums. The following tribute albums to Monk have been released. 4-1, 1982, by Sphere. The band was named after Monk, and the album was coincidentally recorded on the day of his death, Salonica, 1983, by pianist Tommy Flanagan, Light Blue. Arthur Blythe plays Thelonious Monk, 1983, by saxophonist Arthur Blythe. That's the Way I Feel Now, a tribute to Thelonious Monk, 1984, a compilation album featuring rock and jazz musicians including Donald Fagen, Todd Rundgren, Peter Frampton, Carla Bley, Joe Jackson, Gil Evans, and Rosnett Weiss. Six Monk's Compositions, 1987, 1987, by Anthony Braxton, Carmen Sings Monk, 1988, by Carmen McRae, Run the Power Monk, 1988, by Jerry Gonzalez, Monk in Motion, 1989, by Paul Motion, featuring Joe Lovano, Bill Freisel, Jerry Allen, and Dewey Redman. Thelonious Sphere Monk, Dreaming of the Master Series, Volume 2, by the Ensemble of Chicago with Cecil Taylor, Epistrophe, 1991, by pianist Len Blake, EST. Esborn's Vincent Tudor Plays Monk, 1996, by EST. Standard Time, Volume 4, Marcellus Plays Monk, 1999, by Wynton Marcellus, Green Chimneys, The Music of Thelonious Monk, 1999, by Andy Summers, Monk's Casino, 2005, a triple CD set that includes every composition by Monk, by three jazz pianist Alexander von Schlippenbach, an open letter to Thelonious, 2008, by Ellis Marcellus, In Monk's Mood, 2009, by John Chakai, Melodious Monk, A New Look at an Old Master, 2011, by Kim Pencil and Philip Gregg, The Monk Project, 2012, by Jimmy Owens, Baritone Monk, 2012, by The Clare. Daily Quartet, Joey Monk, Live, 2017, by Joey Alexander, John Beasley Presents Monster Volume 1, 2016, by John Beasley, John Beasley Presents Monster Volume 2, 2017, by John Beasley, The Monk, Live at the Blues, 2018, by Neil Hazama and Metropole Orchestra Big Band, a documentary film titled Thelonious Monk, Straight, No Chaser was made in 1988, which discussed his end years and mental illness in detail. His son explained in the movie how Monk did not talk to people for days and then suddenly got excited for a few days and then become a recluse again. A biography on him titled Straight, No Chaser, The Life and Genius of Thelonious Monk, released in 1997, stated how Monk suffered from manic depression, Bipolar disorder and the possible schizophrenia, but his psychiatrists could not recognize it. On two occasions, Monk was found with narcotics and he got in trouble with the law. It was the reason why his cabaret card was revoked for many years and he was not allowed to play music in the nightclubs of New York where alcohol was served. He also went to the prison once where he was beaten with a baton.
You know what we're going to do is we're going to pause here for the cause. We had already heard information concerning Monk having been beaten by the police. We also heard information about Monk being caught with marijuana on more than one occasion. And today, in so many different states here in the United States, where weed is almost legal, it's a shame that this it didn't happen earlier when this man was alive. There are many particular feelings about what happened to Monk in terms of him getting sick and mentally ill. One such statement that I felt that might be more appropriate to Monk getting caught in situations like that was when he got beat by the cops because he wouldn't talk. He wouldn't talk mainly because he was sick, and he didn't probably hear what they were talking about in the first place. In any event, they beat him with a billy club senseless, and I think that had much to do with him getting sick and sicker later on down the road. That's a traumatic experience for any human being. And so what we're going to try to do right now is pull up some more stuff about Monk. My engineer, Mr. Willis, who got a telephone call and is unavailable to help me right now. So as we go on, I'm going to just try to deal with it on my own. But in any event, because we've been hearing a lot of talk, but we haven't heard anything about Monk. We haven't heard a lot of his music. He was fantastic when it came to playing different songs. And so what we're going to do is listen to Thelonious Monk play Straight No Chaser. Thank you. Yeah.
That was Thelonious Monk, straight note chasing. And in fact, that was one of his biggest hits. In fact, he not only wrote the song, which was great, but he also did the arrangements for all of the other instruments. In fact, that's, and anybody who played for Monk will, if they're still alive today, will tell you that Monk arranged, wrote, composed all of the songs. In fact, he's only second to Duke Ellington to the number of songs he did. Here's one that he did called Don't Blame Me.
Thank you.
Yes, you are listening to the program called Getting It Done. And I have as my guest today Jerome Williams and Paul Willis, Paul C. Willis. And we've been listening to some of the genius aspects of the great Thelonious Monk, who I consider to be one of the greatest innovators of our time. Starting off his career back in the 1940s and went all the way up to about 1982 before he passed. I think he was performing all the way up for about 4 years prior to that. If you were listening to the song he just did called Don't Blame Me, you only got the melody on the upbeat, not the downbeat. He did things backwards, and so when he played his music, it sounded that he was playing some crazy stuff, but he was doing things backwardly. And so he never did do music as we would hope that we could hear and understand, and it took a long time for him to catch on because he was so different. But he was definitely a genius. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Jerome, for being a part of this particular show. What did you think about those pieces that we did here, or little things about his life?
I thought it was fantastic. The music was very enlightening. It really talked to and showed us his style of music and how different it was.
Yeah, how about you, Paul?
Yeah, I was just amazed at what he could do with a simple melody and really just take it to another realm. And you can see the musicians, if you watch some of the documentaries and you see the videos, how they're just watching him, and he's just playing. He's just doing his thing. And he was really an innovator and really used the people who came before him and that you've talked with on the show and really took it to another level.
Yeah, he was an innovator. There's no doubt about that. If you think about other people trying to emulate him, they just can't do it. He was a genius. And unless you were a genius, you couldn't hardly understand how he was able to do the things he did, because many of them was like spontaneous, on the spot kind of thing. And it just was just unreal to listen to some of the things he did. And it early in his career, when he wrote the song Around About Midnight, which was a smooth song, and he wrote it straight, but as he got older, he played it in his style and did it his way. He was just that great. Oh, by the way, I'm in Connecticut, and I'm hopefully to be back in South Carolina by the maybe Sunday. In any event, I'll be happy to get back there. It's extremely cold up here. I would look for the warmth, the strong warmth of South Carolina. It's just unreal. You know, it's hard to believe that this man had as one of his idols, the great Art Tatum, because Art Tatum was all over the place with his music, and he was a genius also. So let me tell you a little bit about next week before we conclude our show. We have about 4.5 minutes left, and so next week we're going to hear another great artist, and I'm thinking of Bill Evans, or Gil Evans, as they call him. Bill Evans.
There is a person, Gil Evans. But Bill Evans is the keyboard player.
Keyboard, yeah. I want the one that played with Miles Davis.
Yes.
That's Bill Evans?
Bill Evans.
Okay, Bill Evans. And so we're going to be listening to Bill Evans, who I thought...
Another genius.
Definitely a genius. Could do Monk stuff, but couldn't do Monk completely, but could do any particular style he wanted to do. Was very remarkable in taking songs and changing them around to make them sound so different, but uniquely and independent of anybody else's ability. And what we're going to do, we're going to sort of close out this show called Rhythm Monk 1961. It was recorded at the height of Monk's career. We won't have an opportunity to hear all of the music, but I'll be fading out in 4 minutes. Let's pull it up, Paul. Thank you.
Have a nice week.